It is the morning show. I'm Kate Archer Kent. Thanks to Joy in West Bend, who called in this year requesting we learn more about efforts to promote peace and stability in Ukraine. Nearly a year and a half into Russia's invasion, we get up to speed on developments and examine how the conflict could be resolved. And there's space to talk. Call in with a question or comment at 800-642-1234. Email ideas at WPR.org. Yoshiko Herrera is a political science professor at UW-Madison with expertise on politics in Russia and other post-Soviet states. Yoshiko, welcome back to the Ideas Network.
Thank you. Happy to be here.
Good morning. Looking at news last week, the Biden administration approved sending F-16 fighter jets to Ukraine from NATO members Denmark and the Netherlands. What difference could this air power make in the war Russia instigated against Ukraine 18 months ago?
Well, the F-16s are something that Ukraine has been asking for quite a long time. But the planes will probably not arrive until the end of this year. And so probably they wouldn't have a direct effect until sometime next year. There's got to be training of pilots and things like that. That's ongoing right now. But the planes probably will not arrive for some months.
So it wouldn't have any type of immediate effect on Ukraine's counteroffensive that was launched earlier this summer.
No, I think the counteroffensive depends a lot more on land-based munitions, artillery, et cetera. And so I think that the tanks and munitions are probably more important for the current campaign. But the F-16s are an important, very important signal of continued Western support, a signal of further integration with NATO and Western militaries. So I think that even though the direct military effect might not occur until next year, there's also an effect in terms of morale and signaling. So that's maybe an indirect effect. But yeah, I think that the direct effect won't come until next year.
Does it complicate Western support, specifically the U.S. involvement in supporting Ukraine and fending off Russia?
I don't think it complicates it. I think it's part of a pattern of increasing ratcheting up of Western support for Ukraine. Ukraine at the outset asked for a number of things, including F-16s, including air support, but also Patriot missile systems, tanks, munitions, et cetera. And there was reluctance, I think for, at the time, legitimate reasons, but what in retrospect is looking like maybe not the best policy, there was reluctance to give Ukraine everything it asked for. And I think the primary reason for that was to avoid a direct NATO-Russia confrontation.
Mm-hmm.
I think that was reasonable. That was a reasonable concern. But as we've seen, Russia hasn't responded with nuclear weapons. They don't seem likely to, with increasing Western support for Ukraine. So at this point, I think that Ukraine is getting most of the things it's asked for, but it's been very slow and it's been a kind of step-by-step basis. And the F-16s are sort of the latest in that process.
In those steps. We're talking about the Russian war against Ukraine with UW-Madison political science professor Yoshiko Herrera. You can join in with your questions, your comments, 800-642-1234, email ideas at WPR.org. Checking in on that counteroffensive launched in June, Ukraine counteroffensive against Russian troops. How effective is that effort?
Well, it's still ongoing. Mm-hmm. So I think most analysts are reluctant to give a summary judgment other than to say, I think it's fair to say it's not been as dramatically effective as a lot of people had hoped. Many people in Ukraine are just praying for an end of the war altogether, there was a lot of hope that the spring offensive would result in dramatic gains like we saw last fall. And that hasn't materialized for various reasons. On the other hand, right now, every day, there's discussion of some tactical gains in the Zaporizhia and Donetsk regions. And so I think many people believe the offensive is ongoing, and it probably will go into September. And so we're sort of, you know, wait and see mode. But something we have learned is that, you know, Ukraine is now the most heavily mined country in the world. And it has just been really, really difficult to push Russian forces back because of the level of mining and the Russian artillery, which fires on Ukrainian troops that are moving forward. And Ukraine cares about its troops and is not willing to just send troops into minefields that are being actively shelled. And so it's a very painstaking process to try to make gains in a way that don't result in massive casualties.
Ukrainian forces using American-made cluster bombs. More than 100 countries have signed an international treaty prohibiting the use of these weapons. But Ukraine, Russia, and the U.S. aren't signatories in the treaty. How worrisome is the introduction of cluster bombs as you talk about, you know, such heavily mined lands?
Well, another thing that we're not signatories to our landmine convention. And mm-hmm. I think looking back, the lack of US and Russian support for that international landmine convention is a really unfortunate thing. That's not to say Russia wouldn't have used them anyways, even if they had been a signatory, but the mining is just, you know, a terrible tragedy here. The cluster munitions are also, on the one hand, you know, very not a weapon that anybody would say is a good weapon to use. No weapons are good weapons to use, but it has potential for harming civilians. But I think in this context, in the context of these landmines and these trenches dug in by Russians, in the context of the Russian atrocities that are being committed against civilians, they're a less bad alternative than allowing for continued Russian aggression in the area.
Looking at the leader of the Russian mercenary Wagner group, Yevgeny Prigozhin led the armed mutiny on Russian soil, said his troops are permitted to leave for Belarus. Arrests of several high-ranking military officials close to Prigozhin followed. What is known about the domestic situation inside Russia since the uprising?
Well, this is a very interesting and strange episode. So it seems to have been a mutiny. Prigozhin took his troops out of Ukraine, and they went in two directions, one towards Moscow and one towards Rostov-on-Don, which is a city in southern Russia, which is where the whole command of the Ukraine war is being staged from Russia. So they went to two important places, and he easily managed to overtake the Ministry of Defense building, the southern headquarters in Rostov, and he filmed a video of himself with two senior defense officials there chatting and complaining about the Minister of Defense and the Chief of the General Staff. In addition, his troops going up to Moscow shot down six helicopters and an airplane, resulting in the biggest loss of life for the Russian Air Forces in one day in the whole war. And that was done by Prigozhin's Wagner group against Russian Ministry of Defense troops. So you would think this guy has committed some wrongdoing and should be under arrest in Russia. But instead, he was allowed to move around. He was allowed to go to a meeting with Putin. And his whereabouts, I think he was last seen in Belarus. But importantly, he's not under arrest. He's not facing any significant punishment. And I think the reason for that is that the Russian government and Ministry of Defense was unclear of how much support he has in the military. And they're frankly scared of him, because I think if they could have arrested him, they would have. Instead, they have concentrated on people within the Russian military who were seen to have potentially collaborated with him. Most importantly among them is General Suravikin, who had been the leader of the whole entire Ukraine war operation from October until January. He is a longtime military person serving in several wars. He was the head of the whole Russian air and space forces. So not a small figure, very, very important figure. He has not been seen since the mutiny, and he's supposedly under house arrest. And some of his deputies have been arrested or put under house arrest as well. So it's interesting that they have targeted people within the military who may have been working with Prigozhin, but not Prigozhin himself. The Wagner troops are supposedly in Belarus. And so I think that the whole episode has underlined the weakness of the Putin regime within the military and its inability to act against potential mutineers. But so I think the whole thing has sort of exposed a weakness in the Putin regime.
Political science professor Yoshiko Herrera, fielding your questions, providing analysis on Russia's invasion of Ukraine nearly a year and a half into the conflict. You can be part of this discussion. Call in with a question, share comments, 800-642-1234. I'm Kate Archer-Kent. You're listening to The Morning Show on the Ideas Network. It is The Morning Show. I'm Kate Archer-Kent. We examine Ukraine's counteroffensive nearly a year and a half into the Russian invasion and political breakthroughs that could put the end of the war in sight. A caller request, Joy in West Bend, urging us to look more closely at solutions to bring peace. You can join the conversation, call in with a question, share a comment, 800-642-1234. Yoshiko Herrera is a UW-Madison political science professor who studies U.S.-Russian relations and stays with us. Let's go to Kent in Reedstown. Kent, what would you like to share?
Yeah, our military strategies include direct intervention. Then we've tried tech and advisor support of indigenous troops. Then we tried drone warfare. Now we have a situation where we have aggravated Russia, surrounding them with NATO and nuclear arms, and now we have a proxy war with no risk to U.S. military that keeps our war machine happy and drives our foreign policy.
Ken, thank you for calling in. Yoshiko, what do you make of that analysis, a proxy war with no end in sight?
I think it's fair to ask about whether U.S. military should be involved in any conflict. You know, anywhere in the world, it's fair to debate that. But in this case, it's not correct to say that we have aggravated Russia. Russia invaded Ukraine on its own, by its own decision, without any pretext. There was a big military buildup in 2021. There was a mass of diplomatic flurry throughout the fall of 2022 and into the winter. 2020, going into February 2022, where every leader around the world begged Russia not to invade, to step down, to work out a solution. And Russia rejected all of those options. It could have in February 2022, it could have decided to try to implement the Minsk Treaty, which was very favorable to Russia. Could have done many, many things other than invade. And Russia is the one that decided not only to invade Ukraine, but to wage war against civilians, to commit genocide against Ukrainians. And so it's just incorrect to say that we pushed Russia, the United States or any other country pushed Russia into this war. This is a war of Russian aggression. And there's really no choice but for Ukraine to fight against this aggression, and most countries of the world understand that, and that's why they're supporting Ukraine militarily. Nobody wants a war in this region, and nobody wants a war less than Ukraine, and less than it, and European or U.S. allies. Everybody wants the war to end, and the country that can end the war is Russia.
Looking elsewhere in the world, China is helping Russia evade Western sanctions. China buying Russian oil and gas and supplying Moscow with key technology. How has China's backing helped Russia continue its war on Ukraine?
Well, on the one hand, you could say China is supporting Russia. On the other hand, there's some really important things that China is not doing. China is not supplying Russia with weapons. That's an absolutely important fact. China has also been very clear on no use of nuclear weapons. I think that's also important. What China does, and China is going along, at least in their statements and what they're saying officially, formally, with the sanctions regime. So on the, I would say, very key areas, nuclear weapons, weapons and supplies to Russia, and sanctions, China is cooperating with the West. But what China is doing, in contrast to that, is it's probably violating the sanctions in secret or, you know, covertly. And so, excuse me, some machinery parts and other supplies are getting into Russia. So there's a lot of speculation that China is, in practice, not cooperating with the sanctions. But I think that that's not the same thing as denying the sanctions regime, going against it, et cetera. Mm-hmm. So there's a lot of ways in which China is actually supporting Ukraine and the West in this war. But there are some important ways in which it's also supporting Russia.
We're talking about the Russian war against Ukraine with UW-Madison political science professor Yoshiko Herrera. You can join the conversation and field a question, share comments at 800-642-1234, email ideas at WPR.org. Yoshiko, a year ago, the deal was struck to export Ukrainian grain to other countries. And last month, that arrangement made by the United Nations, Turkey and Russia had collapsed. What has happened there with Russian grain, with Ukraine grain?
Yeah, that's another important issue in the world, because a lot of countries depend on this Ukrainian grain. And there's basically two things that have happened since that grain deal collapsed. One is that Ukraine has been in negotiation with various insurance companies to allow grain out of Ukrainian ports. And that is to have a consortium of insurance companies back some of these ships to allow civilian ships to move through the Black Sea. And there's been some success. One ship, as late as Friday, has gone through. On the other hand, Russia is trying to work out its own deal with Qatar and Turkey that would allow grain exports from Russia into Africa, because the Russian bombardment of Ukrainian ports and the blockage of Ukrainian grain is having a direct effect in countries in the Middle East and North Africa. And Russia worries that its limited support that it has internationally will decline even further if they're seen to be the country that's blocking these grain exports. So they're on the one hand blocking the grain exports, and they're on the other hand trying to work out a deal that excludes Ukraine. But at the same time, Ukraine is working on this deal with insurance companies that's going to allow ships to go through despite Russia's reluctance. And a very important player in this is Turkey. Turkey was critical to getting the grain deal in place previously, and Turkey is a NATO member. And so I think there is some hope that Turkey will, again, play a role. But at the moment, the grain deals are in flux.
Yoshiko Herrera is a UW-Madison political scientist whose research involves politics in Russia and post-Soviet states. As we discuss aspects of Russia's war in Ukraine, what comes up for you? You can add your perspective to the discussion at any point. Call in now with a question, share a concern about this war, 800-642-1234. Email ideas at WPR.org. I'm Kate Archer-Kent. You're listening to The Morning Show here on the Ideas Network. It is The Morning Show. I'm Kate Archer-Kent. What might bring a lasting ceasefire in Ukraine? What is the vision for how Russia's invasion of Ukraine ends? Thanks to a listener request, Joy in West Bend, who wants to examine what could bring peace in Ukraine. And there's space to talk. Call in with a question. Share comments. 800-642-1234. Email ideas at WPR.org. UW-Madison political science professor Yoshiko Herrera is our guide. Let's bring on a call, Marcus in Milwaukee. Hi, Marcus.
Hi, good morning, Kate. So my question is, my brother and I were having a conversation. We came across something that said the United States and China has signed a mutual defense pact. Should we be attacked from outer space by presumably extraterrestrials? I don't think it really quite spells it out, but that's what the gist of it.
And what in relation to Ukraine here, Marcus?
No, I'm just curious in terms of that seems like a rather large step to take with China, being that we can barely agree on hardly anything from Foxconn on. And, you know, it's just it just makes me wonder what, you know, if your guest has any insights on this as to what might actually be going on.
Yoshiko, any insights there on a defense pact with China?
There was news last year about China and Russia signing, and this was before the war, a pact, China and Russia signing a pact about preventing an arms race in outer space. But I don't think that's really that relevant for this war because the threats are not coming from outer space. And actually just yesterday or just recently, Russia's attempt to land a rocket on the moon crashed. So I don't think at the moment Russia's space program is going very well. So I think there was discussion of that. But China made very clear in the meeting, their most recent meeting of Xi Jinping in Moscow, that it was not in a military alliance with Russia. So I think that's kind of the more proximate and relevant aspect of Chinese-Russian relations militarily right now.
Is diplomacy likely to work when Ukrainian and Russian interests are seemingly incompatible?
Yeah, this is a really important question. And everybody is for... Everybody except for Vladimir Putin and Russia are in favor of ending this war. But here's why the diplomatic solution is not likely to work out. Number one, Russia has not changed its goals since the start of the war at all. They have only ramped up their aggressive tactics. So Russia essentially wants control over Ukraine. They tried to do that by taking over Kiev and they failed. And they tried to do that by demoralizing the population in Ukraine through bombing of civilian targets, which they continue to do. And also through committing atrocities in Ukrainian held territory by forcibly deporting children, old people, disabled people into Russia, taking away their documents. It's mass deportations of people and children, adults and children, that I think we're only going to learn the full extent of when this war is over. In addition to torture and murdering of Ukrainians in those areas. So there's been no change in that. There's no sign from the Russian side that, okay, actually they're willing to stop any of that. And now they want to have peaceful relations with Ukraine. In addition, Putin, there's a lot of evidence that Putin is indifferent to the costs of war. Whereas in the United States or in Ukraine, the leadership cares about how many soldiers are killed, how many civilians are killed, etc. There's no indication that Vladimir Putin cares how many Russian soldiers are killed. And what that means is that in normal circumstances, when somebody cares about the costs of war, if the war becomes costly, they might say, like, okay, I didn't realize it would be this bad. I guess we should do something different. Maybe we need to end the war. There's nothing like that going on in the Putin government. There's no even acknowledgement of the cost of war, let alone taking those into consideration to change their goals.
Change course. Mm-hmm.
Yes.
Is Ukraine willing to give up any territory to reach a peace deal to end the war, if the sides would come to the negotiation table?
I think that the calculus here has to take into account a couple of things. Number one, in the areas that Russia controls, what we know about those areas in the eastern part of Ukraine is that Russia is committing atrocities and even genocide in those areas. So what it means to give up territory is to subject people of Ukraine to that torture and abuse by Russian military and Russian authorities. And so I think it's not just saying, will you give up this land? It's saying, will you give up people to Russia with no recourse to be rescued from this situation? So I think one of the difficulties is that Russians have behaved so badly in the areas that they occupy that it makes giving up land not just about land, but about what about the people in those areas? Mm-hmm. That's the first thing. The second is that given the aggressiveness of Russia, the idea that you could have a ceasefire and then go back to living your life is just fanciful. What Russia will do with a ceasefire is it will, and what we've seen in the last year is that as long as it controls that territory, it will dig in, it will put in defenses, it will put in more landmines in all the areas that it controls. And so it's not going to result in, there's not going to be peace in Ukraine after a ceasefire. A ceasefire will allow Russia time to regroup, rearm, dig in its defenses, and stage the next battle for control over Ukraine, because that goal has not changed. So I think that the challenge of asking Ukrainians now, will you give up land for peace, is that they know there will not be peace in that land that Russia controls. There will be more torture and abuse of its citizens, and that Russia will use that ceasefire as a period to stage further battles. So unfortunately, and even if Ukraine were theoretically willing to give up some territory per se, maybe with its citizens evacuated, et cetera, they're unlikely to say or telegraph that now. So mm-hmm. I think when we ask, are they willing to do it? Like, even if they were, they would not say so. But I think for the reasons I outlined, they're unlikely to be willing to give up territory at this time, because that means giving up their people.
Giving up on their people. UW Madison political science professor Yoshiko Herrera, as we talk about the Russian war against Ukraine. And you can join in with your questions, your comments, 800-642-1234. Ernest is here in Hayward. Hi, Ernest. Go ahead.
You know, our proxy war with Russia and Ukraine has a precedent in the 1980s when we provoked the Soviet Union into invading Afghanistan, and then we armed radical Muslims, which gave birth to Al quota, but we were successful because the Soviet Union imploded afterwards. And I think our objective in Ukraine is the same. We're trying to do a regime change, get rid of Putin, and break up what's remaining of Russia into small republics, which would not be a potential threat to us. Remember, Russia is the largest country in the world, and that is really a threat to our hegemony. And I think it's similar with China. China is a tremendous economic power, and we don't like that.
Ernest, thank you. What do you make of Ernest's perspective on the geopolitical dynamics here, Yoshiko?
I think it's a good idea, and it's reasonable to think about historical parallels, comparisons with Afghanistan, and the larger geopolitical arena. But I have to disagree in a couple of important ways. One is the United States absolutely did not provoke Russia into invading Afghanistan. Russia invaded the Soviet Union, invaded Afghanistan because it wanted to protect its Soviet-backed government from other elements in Afghanistan. And in fact, the United States opposed that invasion. People may remember the boycott of the Olympics, et cetera. So that's a long story of, you know, what's happening in Afghanistan, but it's very different from Ukraine in several ways. One is, from the United States perspective, at least from our most recent experience in Afghanistan, U.S. troops are not doing the fighting in Ukraine. So we are supporting Ukrainians who are trying to protect their own country. And I think that is a very important difference with a lot of the conflicts in Afghanistan, where you had foreign fighters in the country. In this case, you have Ukrainians that are just asking for support. That's one thing. Second, on whether the United States has an interest in breaking up Russia, the U.S. and Russia and the U.S. and China have a divergence of interests, and that's clear. We have different interests. Russia and China are both in favor, and the current governments are both in favor of greater authoritarianism, a greater focus on quashing dissent, human rights, and they're anti-democratic. So we do have a conflict of interests with both Russia and China. But I don't think that extends to saying the United States wants to break up those countries or dissemble those countries in some way. I think we have to understand that some countries we can work with, even if we have big disagreements. But in this case, the goals are much more limited, which is to get Russia out of Ukraine. And I think that the world has seen that Putin is a terrible leader. He's not only inflicted incredible damage on Ukraine, but he's also ruined Russia as a country. I don't think there's any worse leader for Russia than Vladimir Putin. So I don't think I'm alone in thinking Russia would be better off without him as a leader. I think many Russians would agree with that as well. But that doesn't mean there's a United States goal of regime change in Russia, even if we recognize that Putin has been a terrible leader for Russia as well as for the rest of the world.
Yoshiko Herrera, professor of political science at UW-Madison, research involves Russian politics, fielding questions about the war and Russia's ambition to control Ukraine. Call in now with a question, share a comment at 800-642-1234. I'm Kate Archer-Kent. You're listening to The Morning Show on the Ideas Network. It is The Morning Show. I'm Kate Archer-Kent. As Ukrainian forces fight a counteroffensive, we examine any prospects for an agreement to stop Russia's aggression nearly a year and a half into its war. You can add a discussion point as we look more deeply at the war in Ukraine, thanks to a listener request. Call in with a question or express concerns, 800-642-1234. Yoshiko Herrera is a political science professor at UW-Madison. Let's go to Doug now in Mason. Good morning, Doug. Go ahead.
Hi, Professor Herrera. Good morning to you, ma'am. I'd like to pose the question, which probably is completely absent from this whole debate, if we can reduce it to just simply a debate, because, of course, you realize it's much more serious than that. But as you're aware, there's been violation after violation of this document that seems to become very minor, that being the United Nations Charter of 1946, in which 50 million people died to establish it in the hopes of establishing some form of world order, dignity, and peace for mankind. Now, it's obviated that it has been discussed, and there's been sanction, and there's been verbiage upon verbiage, but it's also obviated that there's United Nations peacekeepers designated and established in at least 12 different countries across the globe.
Doug, let's get Yoshiko to respond here to what is the status of the United Nations involving peacekeeping efforts?
Yeah, thanks. That's a good question. The UN General Assembly, right from the outset, adopted a resolution demanding that Russia leave Ukraine. 141 states voted in favor, and only 7 voted against, including Russia. And there were 32 abstentions, including China, India, and Pakistan. So it's pretty clear that in the UN, the vast majority of states want Russia to leave Ukraine. Unfortunately, Russia is not listening to that resolution, and peacekeepers from the UN are unlikely to work because Russia is just violating international law and acting in a violent and aggressive manner. I mean, you can't. The idea of a peacekeeper is to stand between, let's say, two conflicting parties who are more or less willing to be at peace with each other, but just need some kind of monitoring. In this case, Russia is just pushing all that aside and saying, we are just going to use force wherever we want. We're going to send our bombs into cities. We're going to fire on whoever we want. It doesn't matter. We're going to fire on hospitals. We're going to kidnap children. And so in that kind of an aggressive context, the neutral peacekeeper is not going to be able to do their job. Ukrainian military is in an active war with Russian forces, and they would love to be in a peacekeeping situation where they're just patrolling or monitoring and there isn't active warfare. But unfortunately, Russia is actively acting with violence against Ukrainian citizens and Ukraine as a state. And so unfortunately, the UN hasn't been able to play a more active role. And one of the reasons, of course, is because Russia is a member of the Security Council.
As Doug brings up the United Nations, what about Ukraine being allowed into the European Union? Would that increase U.S. exposure to Russian aggression? And what would be the status as it is a member candidate to the European Union?
I think that I certainly think, and I think many analysts think, that at this point, Russia has no way of winning this war. It's just a matter of time and, unfortunately, a matter of costs of how many Ukrainians are going to be killed, how many Russians are going to be killed in this war. But the war is going to end with Russian forces being pushed out eventually. I don't think anybody thinks at this point that there's any chance of Russia actually winning this war. And when the war ends, Ukraine is going to join the EU and it's going to join NATO. And I think that both of those things are going to solidify support for Ukraine and are going to act as a deterrent against further Russian aggression. So rather than thinking that will exacerbate tensions, I think Ukraine joining the EU and joining NATO is going to be the deterrent that Ukraine has needed to deter Russia further.
Let's bring in Jane and Suamico. Jane, hi.
Hi. I wondered if she could speak to the number of Russian soldiers dying and what the people of Russia are hearing about the numbers there of losses.
Thanks, Jane. Yoshiko.
Yeah, that's a great question. The U.S. Intelligence Services just recently put out estimates of 120,000 Russian soldiers killed, which is an incredible number for a war of this length. But within Russia, they're actively downplaying the number of casualties that includes killed, wounded, and missing. And some of the reasons for that, well, the obvious propaganda reason is they don't want to highlight the losses. But another thing is that they recruited a lot of soldiers from prisons and from poorer regions of Russia. So these are people that don't have a lot of social capital, a lot of say in the country, not to mention the fact that the country has gone fully authoritarian. So even anybody that wants to speak out against the war is severely limited. The government is actively arresting, you know, teenagers, writers, people who posted something on their equivalent of Facebook, you know, years ago. So the government is going after any kind of critics. It's against the law to criticize the armed forces of Russia. It's against the law to say that there is a war going on. You're not allowed to use that word. You have to say special military operation. So there's just been a massive crackdown on any kind of dissent, and dissent related to the war in particular. And so discussion of casualties, et cetera, would fall into that. So anybody that's criticizing the cost of the war would be in the same category of those criticizing the war generally and subject to repression by the government. So there's not a lot of discussion on the state-controlled media of the casualties. And a lot of people who are dying are coming from the most vulnerable and areas of Russia with the least social capital. And so it's hard for those people to complain in any significant way that gets their voices heard in the country.
Yoshiko, thank you for joining us.
You're very welcome.
Yoshiko Herrera is a professor in political science at UW-Madison, where she studies politics in Russia and other post-Soviet states, nationalism, identity, and ethnic politics. I'm Kate Archer-Kent. You're listening to The Morning Show here on the Ideas Network.